hard. Average scores and times are up there. I've plotted over here on the right the average times for previous classes, years. And so that's the total time in the graph. So it's basically the number of hours in CDS 110 plus 3, right? And in CDS 101 plus 2. So we were doing good. So this is the fourth time I've taught this class with this basic set of material. These were the first 2 years. This was the third year. You see we managed to bring things down. 12.5 plus 3, 15.5. We're back up here again. Okay. So we've got some work to do to bring them down. We will try and do that. This week's homework typically spiked up. We tried to bring it down. We continue to try and bring the times down. Right. The correct number is here, 9. Okay. So on average, right? Some people spend more. Some people will spend less. So we are working to bring them down, but it is a challenge. We thought we were making the problem sets a little easier, but we do change the problems every year, right? Because new stuff happens. Okay, homework number 3, due at 5 o'clock today. Again, these hours are important for us for tracking from year to year to year and looking at the problems and what's taking time. It really is useful feedback to us. Please take the 30 seconds it takes to estimate the number of hours. Homework number 4 is available on the web. Please do not pick it up until about 8 o'clock tonight. The version that's out there has a couple of little bugs that need to get fixed. If you grab it right now, you'll have the wrong version. So please wait until 8 o'clock tonight. And you have your laptop with you, Mary?
Yes.
Can you just put something next to the link or maybe blank out the link so it doesn't actually link anywhere? Just so that we don't accidentally get people grabbing it. And midterms are coming up. So the midterm will be handed out on Wednesday, the 25th of October. There will be no homework that week, so you'll do today's homework. Then next Wednesday in class, I'll hand out the midterm. It will be due at the end of midterms period, which is Tuesday at 5 o'clock. That should be Halloween. There will be a homework handed out on Monday, the 30th of October. All right. So just for your own scheduling, you'll get the midterm replaces a homework set. So, but I'm not going to hand it out until midterm week or midterm start, and it'll be due at the end of midterm week. But you'll get a homework. We'll stay on the Monday cycle. Okay. All right. Any questions on course administrative stuff? Yeah.
For the people doing the project.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Thank you. For people doing the project. So, two things on that. One is that on the homework set number 4, the fourth problem is one in which there are two optional problems that you could do instead of the fourth problem. One of the optional problems is obviously the project problem, right? It has to do with steering control of a vehicle. So you should do that problem instead of the other one. Take you about the same amount of time. It's a little bit harder. So that's one thing for the project. The other is that next week I will have a set of auxiliary lectures on implementation on ALICE, and we'll basically start the project stuff next week. So if you're planning to do the project, the first thing you should do is do, I think it's problem number 6 on this homework in place of problem number 4. And it'll say that. And then the second thing is we'll set up some meetings for next week. I'll send out some email to the class list where we'll sit and we'll talk about how does ALICE work, what do you have to do to implement things. We're finally, basically next week, we'll get to the point where we define a controller. There'll be something for us to implement so we can start talking about doing that implementation. Okay? Other questions? Okay. So today's lecture is on linear systems. This week is on linear systems. This is out of chapter 5 of the book. And what I want to do today is describe what a linear system model is, give some of the properties of a linear system, some examples, and some of the tools for working with linear systems. We will, throughout the rest of the course, make extensive use of linear systems. I want to then characterize the stability and performance of linear systems using eigenvalues and talk about how you compute the linearization of a system, of a nonlinear system, around an equilibrium point. So that's the plan for today. All right, so last week we talked about dynamic behavior and the notion that we can have an equilibrium point, we can talk about stability of that equilibrium point, we can talk about the local behavior around that equilibrium point or the global behavior further away from that equilibrium point, and we can look at step responses and other mechanisms for talking about the performance of a system. So stability and performance are separate notions, and for example, the system is all of these systems, which involves an interchange of parameters, are stable but have different performance. So today what we want to do is start refining our tools for looking at stability and performance of systems. And so we're going to do that by looking at a special class of systems, namely linear systems. So what's a linear system? So first, let's just recall what a linear function is. If I have a function going from n real numbers to n real numbers, so a vector-valued function that takes a vector argument, then we say that function is linear if it satisfies a number of properties. One property is that it should be zero at the origin. The function evaluated at zero should equal to zero. Another is that if I add two inputs together, so if I add the arguments of this function together, I should get the sum of the function. In other words, f applied to x plus y should be f of x plus f of y. That's the linearity of that function. And the third property has to do with scaling. If I scale the input to a function, then the output of that function should be scaled. And so if I just have a function, just a plain old nonlinear map, we'll say that that nonlinear map is in fact linear if these three properties are true. And we'll often just write that in sort of a single form as the function applied to alpha x plus beta y. We should be able to distribute this, right? So we should be able to pull the summation out and pull the scaling out. So f of alpha x plus beta y is alpha times f of x plus beta times f of y. And the kind of canonical linear function is just f of x equals ax, where a is an n by n matrix. And it's easy to verify that these properties are true for matrix multiplication, right? Scalars can be pulled out in front of the matrix multiplication. A times x plus y is ax plus ay, just from linearity of matrix multiplication, matrix vector multiplication. So for functions, hopefully this is all familiar, or at least easy. So this is the definition of linearity for functions. Now, what if we're talking about a system? So we're looking at a dynamical system. What do we mean by saying that the system is linear? And what we mean is that the sum of solutions is linear. So instead of looking at the output of a linear function, we look at the solution of a linear system. And so if we have a dynamical system, x dot equals ax, one type of linearity we can look at is linearity with respect to the initial condition. So suppose that I have an initial condition x1, 0, and I have an initial condition x2, 0, and suppose that the solution that I get to this system, if I plug in initial condition x1, 0, is x1 of t, and suppose the solution from initial condition x2 of 0 is x2 of t, then we'll say that the system is linear if, when I apply x alpha x1 0 plus alpha x2 0, I get a linear combination of the solutions. So it's exactly analogous to what's happening up here, except that now I want to look at the solution and say that the solution is a linear combination of the individual solutions. Right? Does that make sense? So that's just for a dynamical system. So we'll say a dynamical system is linear if this property is true. And it will turn out that all linear dynamical systems can be written in this form, and this form is a linear dynamical system. So effectively, a linear dynamical system will always look like this. All right, that's without any inputs, right? We care in control systems and feedback systems about systems with inputs. So if we have a control system of this form, x dot equals ax plus bu, y equals cx plus du, x is the state, an n vector, a is an n by n matrix, u is an input, let's take it to be a scalar, b is a column vector of height n, so that all of these add up correctly, y is an output, let's take it to be a scalar, c is a row vector of length n, and d is a scalar, just a one-by-one matrix if you want, or a scalar, because we have a scalar input and a scalar output. Then we'll say that this system is linear, and by that we mean that if I take zero initial condition and some input u1 that gives me output y1, and then I take zero initial condition and some input u2 that gives me y2, then the solution to this should be zero initial condition, and applying u equals alpha u1 plus beta u2, I get y equals alpha y1 plus beta y2. Notice that we have to set the initial condition equal to zero to do this, and I'll show you a different way of looking at it that makes that clear. But in this, we say that a control system is linear if, when I apply an input at zero initial condition, one input at zero initial condition, and another input at zero initial condition, that if I apply a weighted combination of those two inputs at zero initial condition, I get a weighted combination of the individual outputs. So exact same thing. Right? So this is the definition of a linear system, and it will linear control system. And again, it will be the case that if this property is satisfied for an arbitrary system, it can always be written in this form. Right? And this form will always generate solutions like this. And we're going to derive this and sort of show it a little bit later when we look at the solutions. Okay, so that's the definition of linearity. These two, this block here for dynamical systems, this block here for control systems. All right, so another way of looking at linear systems sort of visualizing this is often called superposition. And so this is basically just saying the same thing. We'll say that an input-output system is linear if when I sum up different inputs, I get the sum of the outputs. So, in particular, if I put a sinusoid into U1 that gives me Y1 as an output, and I put a different sinusoid in, or any function, but a sinusoid here is U2, and it gives me another output, then if I take the sum of those two sinusoids, I get an output that's the sum of the output sinusoids. So, another way of saying this is that if I superimpose the inputs, that means sum them together, I get a superposition of the outputs. So we'll say that it has a superposition property, and this is just saying in pictures the same thing that we said in equations. For a linear system, that also means that if I scale the input, I get a scaled version of the output. And so if I put in twice the input to a linear system, I get twice the output. So if I had one input and I double it, then whatever the output was doubles. And what that means is that we can use ratios and percentages for a linear system. That is, when I say a step response, it doesn't matter whether the step response is of size 1 or of size 10. If I normalize by the size of the input, right, then it will always divide out properly. Because if I put in 10 times the input, I get out 10 times the output. So if I divide by the input magnitude, the factor of 10 goes away. And so when we talk about step response, we'll always talk about unit step response because the size of the input doesn't matter. And so typically in linear systems, we talk about ratios and percentages because those become independent of the magnitude. One limit is that often a linear system will have input saturation. You saw input saturation, for example, in the homework set this week for the cruise control system. So even if I have a linear system, if it has input saturation, then of course, once I start saturating these inputs, then the linearity property stops holding. So you have to be careful. No system is linear globally. All models of systems that are linear are local models of what's going on, right? At some point it breaks down. All right, so that's sort of the idea of a linear system. Now, why do we care about linear systems? So there are lots of reasons why we care about linear systems. One is that they just come up a lot. So it turns out that many examples of systems are linear. For example, if you work in electrical engineering and electronic circuits of various sorts, it turns out that linear systems come up all of the time, mainly because we want the systems to be linear. We want an amplifier to give us linear response across frequencies, for example. It may be that the individual elements start out nonlinear, but we'll often wrap feedback around them in a way that makes the system linear after feedback. And so often when we're looking at electronic circuits, linear systems are the proper model, and frequency response, which we'll talk about a little bit more in a minute, is one of the key ways that we specify things for linear systems. It also turns out that a lot of mechanical systems are linear. Masses and springs are one, so this is a linear mechanical system here. And a variety of mechanical systems, especially when you're thinking about mechanical systems that have small deviations, linear models are good models. And finally, quantum mechanics and Markov chains and lots of other types of systems are linear. So there are lots of examples where the natural description of a system is a linear system. And so one reason they're important is because a lot of systems are well described by linear models. Another reason that they're important is because we have tools to work with linear models. And so ideas of frequency response and step response are some of the traditional tools of control theory. They are derived for linear systems, and these are the tools that you use every day. There are things that we'll learn in the second half of this course, having to do with Nyquist plots and gain phase and loop shaping, that are the classical design tools. So we have analysis tools, how do I look at a linear system and characterize its performance. We have design tools, how do I take a linear system and design a feedback law that gives me the desired dynamics. There are also more sophisticated tools that we can use from optimal control theory and other places that work very well for linear systems. And finally, the most sophisticated tools that we have in robust control, where we start worrying about uncertainty, are again defined for linear systems. So there's this little bit of a funny thing, right? So Lots of systems are linear, so that's good, and people have gone and developed tools. And now we have a really rich tool set. Basically, all of the things you want to do for linear systems, we can do. What that means is that now you're kind of pushed into using linear systems because that's where all your design tools live. So if you have a nonlinear system, the first thing that you try and do is either approximate it by a linear system or turn it into a linear system so that you can apply your design tools. Otherwise, you're stuck. And so this going back and forth between having the tools and what the model is sort of feeds both ways. Now you use linear systems partly because you just have good tools for doing things on linear systems. All right, so in this class, we're going to focus primarily on this top set of design tools, and this will be the second half of the class. In 110B, we'll do things for linear systems using these types of tools. And if you're interested in robust control design, we'll talk a little bit about robust analysis. But if you're interested in the design problems, that's what you do in CDS 212. All right, so we've got this idea of linear systems. I'm claiming they're important and that they get used all the time. So now let's go look at some of these tools that we have available for doing things. And so the very first thing that we're going to want to do is ask, what is the solution of a linear differential equation? And so we're going to first study the case where we ignore the input. And so we're going to get rid of this particular input here. And we're going to look at a scalar system. So suppose I first just take x to be a scalar, and I look at x dot equals ax, that's a linear system with no input, y equals cx, that's a linear output, and some initial condition. Well, this is one that hopefully everybody in the room can solve, and the solution to this differential equation is just an exponential, e to the at times x0. Right? So you can plug this in and see that, in fact, it satisfies this differential equation, and the output is just c times x, so c e to the at times x0. Right? Easy enough. If we have a matrix version, right, so now suppose x dot equals ax and y equals cx, and we have some initial condition, then it turns out that we can formally write the solution in the same form. We write e to the at times x0, and y is just c times e to the at times x0. Now, we have to be a little careful with what this thing means, right, because this is the exponential of a matrix, an n by n matrix. So you probably haven't seen that definition. What that is defined as, that matrix exponential, is this series expansion. All right? I don't know what the L is at the end. So e to the m, a matrix m, is just the identity matrix plus m plus 1 over 2 factorial m squared plus 1 over 3 factorial m cubed plus dot, dot, dot. Replace m, replace L with dot, dot, dot. That expansion. All right? So this is, of course, exactly the normal Taylor series expansion for the exponential, right? It's 1 plus, right, 1, if this was e to the little m, this would be 1 plus m plus 1 half m squared plus 1 over 6 m cubed, right, that normal expansion you do for an exponential. So all you do is plug in the matrix to that. Note, this is not the exponential of the individual entries of the matrix, all right? So if I give you a matrix, it's not taking the exponential of each of the entries. It's different than that. These m's, when they multiply together, combine all the terms together. Right? So that's the definition of a matrix exponential. And it turns out that with that definition, you can show that this is a solution of this differential equation. And you basically do that by putting putting at in for m, expanding this out, taking the derivative with respect to t, and seeing what you get out of it, and showing that it satisfies that differential equation. Right? Which it does. All right, so in the usual way, you don't actually have to do any of these calculations. If you want to take the exponential of a matrix in MATLAB, you use the xm command. Takes the exponential of a matrix and gives you that. And if you want to get this solution, there's a command special for that called initial. So if you give the ABCD matrix and the initial condition to this MATLAB command, it will generate y of t for you. So there are commands for all of these things. Right, because they come up all the time. Okay, so for a linear system, the matrix exponential is the way that we'll define the system, and I'll go through a little bit more detailed derivation of this on Wednesday, but an easy thing to verify, a nice little exercise in linear algebra, is that if I use this expansion formula and plug it in this differential equation, it is in fact a solution. All right, so that's this notion of a matrix exponential. Now let's try and understand how we might use that to study the stability of a linear system. So what we're going to do for right now is we're going to turn the input off. So we're just going to look at the stability of x dot equals ax. And we've already seen that the solution can be written as x of t equals e to the at. And the question is, when is this system asymptotically stable? And in particular, when do the solutions approach zero as t approaches infinity? We also need to show that it's stable in the sense of Lyapunov, but I'm just going to show here the part of this that has to do with converging to zero. And it is, it turns out, if it converges to zero for a linear system, it will be stable in the sense of Lyapunov. All right, so the stability of a linear system is determined by the eigenvalues of that linear matrix, A. And you can see this in a number of different ways. So one is, if I look at a diagonal matrix, let's look at that case. Suppose that I have x dot equals lambda 1 in the diagonal, lambda 1 down to lambda n in the diagonals, and 0 everywhere else. So, in particular, this differential equation is just x1 dot equals lambda 1 x1, x2 dot equals lambda 2 x2, right? All the way down to xn dot equals lambda n times xn. That we can solve because it's just a bunch of scalar equations, and we see that the solution is x of t equals, and in this special case, you do just get the exponentials of the individual elements, so it's e to the lambda 1 t on the diagonal all the way down to e to the lambda n t. And we can see that this system is stable if lambda I equals 0, so replace that with equals 0, not dot 0. It's asymptotically stable if lambda I is less than 0, and it's unstable if lambda I is greater than 0. Why? Well, let's do the asymptotically stable case first. If lambda I is less than 0, then e to the lambda t is e to some negative number. If t gets very large, that's e to some large negative number, right? And that gets closer and closer to 0 as t gets larger and larger, right? Because it's to the negative power, so it's like 1 over e to the lambda. So this certainly converges to zero, and in fact you can see that it's also stable in the sense of Lyapunov in that I always decrease in this particular case toward the origin. So I always move inside. If lambda I is, if any of the lambda I's are greater than zero, then of course the corresponding exponential element blows up as t goes to infinity, so it's clearly unstable. If lambda is equal to zero for each of these, or for any of these rather, then for the one where it's equal to zero, I'll get e to the lambda I t is equal to one, which means that x at time t is equal to x zero, which means I don't move. But it's true that if I start close, I stay close. Right? So it's stable in the sense of Lyapunov. All right, so this shows what happens for a diagonal system. In the more general case, we have to worry about how all of the eigenvalues interact. And in the general case, what we do is, it turns out that we can always transform a matrix A into something called a Jordan form. And a Jordan form is a block diagonal form, so this A is equal to T inverse JT, where J is a block diagonal matrix with K blocks, and each block is itself of this form. It has the eigenvalues on the diagonal and the ones on the superdiagonal. So that's something called a Jordan form. If you haven't seen a Jordan form yet, don't worry about it. We'll talk about it more on Wednesday. You probably saw some of it in the linear algebra review, and you'll see lots of it in ACM 95 or ACM 100 if you take one of those courses. Now, turns out that for a general matrix, it's a little bit, you have to be a little bit more careful. It's still true that if the real parts, so Jordan forms can generally have complex eigenvalues, so if the real parts of those eigenvalues are strictly less than zero, asymptotically stable, roughly the same argument as up here. If any of the real parts are greater than zero, then it's unstable, same argument as the diagonal case. But if the real parts of lambda are equal to zero, you can't tell. Could be stable, could be unstable. Right? So you actually can't tell. And an easy example to see that is if you just look at these two systems. Here's one system. It's a scalar system. X dot equals zero. And here's another system. It's a second order system. X double dot equals zero. The eigenvalues for both of these are 0. This has two eigenvalues, lambda 1, lambda 2. They're both equal to 0. Okay. The solution for this is x of t equals x at time 0. That's stable in the sense of Lyapunov, right? Start close, stay close. The solution to this is x of t equals x of 0 plus x prime of 0. So I'll call this let me call this Q, just to keep from getting myself confused. So Q of t is Q of 0 plus Q prime of 0, these are the two states, times t. If t grows, the solution grows. Right? As t goes to infinity, solution goes to infinity. So zero eigenvalues, there's one that's unstable, there's one that's stable and ostensibly half and off. So you have to be careful. Alright, so but what we're going to care about is designing systems that are stable, and so we will always make the real part of the eigenvalues be less than zero. Alright, so the key takeaway from this part, again on Wednesday we'll go through some of the details of this, but is that the form of the eigenvalues, whether the real part is positive or negative, determines the system behavior, at least in terms of stability. One other property of linear systems in the context of local and global stability is that linear systems are automatically globally stable or unstable. It doesn't matter what the size is because it's a linear system. So if I start 10 times further away, it looks just like the dynamics look like starting close, just 10 times bigger, right? So it's all linear. So whatever the behavior was close by is the same as the behavior is far away because they're just linear multiples of each other. Right? So for linear systems, it makes sense to talk about stability and not worry about local versus global. It's also the case that for linear systems, the equilibrium point, x equals 0 is always an equilibrium point. And so I tend to get sloppy, and lots of people tend to get sloppy and say a linear system is stable, right? By which we mean the equilibrium point at 0 is globally asymptotically stable. Right? So we'll just say, oh yeah, this is a stable linear system. Right? Not what we should say, but because in linear systems, that's almost always what you mean. That's the way it works out. All right, so the eigenvalues are obviously important for determining stability. They also tell us something about what the dynamics look like. And so here, for example, are phase plane portraits for four different linear systems. This is a linear system where the real part of the eigenvalues are all less than zero. So you see all of the solutions are converging into the origin. Here's a system where the real parts of the eigenvalues are equal to zero. This is one that's stable in the sense of Lyapunov, so all of the solutions are spinning around. If I start at some point, I just stay on a circle. So if I start close, I stay close. Here's an example where one of the eigenvalues is less than zero, but the other one's greater than zero. And what this phase portrait looks like is on this line, I'm coming into the origin from here, but every place else, I'm escaping away to infinity. And finally, if I have complex eigenvalues, so here, in fact, the eigenvalues are real. If I have complex eigenvalues with real part less than zero, I can get these swirling patterns. So the eigenvalues map directly to the types of phase portraits that we get. And so when we study linear systems, we basically study the eigenvalues of those linear systems because they tell us more or less everything we want to know about the system, at least in terms of stability and often in terms of performance. All right, so one tool for linear systems is just stability. Stability for a linear system corresponds to looking at the eigenvalues of the appropriate matrix, the A matrix in the system I wrote down. Now, another property of linear systems that's important is the performance of linear systems. And we'll often do performance for linear systems in terms of the frequency response. Actually, we use both step response and frequency response. I defined step response last week. Let me talk about frequency response. So if I have a linear system, one of the questions that I can ask is, if I put in a sinusoid at some frequency and amplitude, what's the corresponding frequency and amplitude of the sinusoid that I get out? So first off, it turns out, and we'll show this via calculation in a second, that sinusoidal inputs always generate sinusoidal outputs at the same frequency, but the magnitude of the sinusoid could get bigger or smaller, and the phase of the sinusoid could get bigger and smaller. And so what we really want to know is, if I put in a sinusoid, how do the magnitude and phase vary? So for example, in an audio amplifier, what you'd like is that it's flat between 20 hertz and 20,000 hertz, which is where your ear can hear, because you'd like that if I'm talking and my voice is being amplified, and then somebody with a higher pitch voice or a lower pitch voice comes in and talks, that it gets amplified the same amount. Or my voice consists of a bunch of tones, and you don't want the lower tones and the higher tones to get amplified different amounts, because it will distort the signal. So we would there want a flat frequency response. That is, we would want that the frequency, the magnitude should get bigger if it's an amplifier, but it should be a constant factor bigger, right, as I sweep across frequencies. So when we do these types of things, one of the ways you do that is you just use individual sinusoids as test signals. That is, you put them in and you see what happens. So for a linear system, you can probe the dynamics of the system by using sinusoids. All right, so If we want to calculate out what the frequency response is, we will define this in terms of the gain and phase. And so the idea is that if I start with my input A, my input sinusoid, that's the dashed blue line here as a sinusoid, if it has amplitude AU, that's my input amplitude, I then look at what the output sinusoid is, that's the green one here, and I call its amplitude AY, then I define the gain of the system to be the ratio of the output over the input amplitude, AY over AU. So if we talk about the gain of a system, if it's a gain of 10, that means that the output is 10 times bigger than the input. We can also talk about the phase of the system, and by the phase we mean how much does it shift the sinusoid. Right? So maybe they line up right on top of one another, in which case it's phase zero, or maybe one of them is slightly behind the other, or more behind the other, or more behind the other. And the delta T here, compared to the entire period, is a measure of the phase. So we'll say that it is delta T over T times 2 pi will be the phase in radians. So if it's pi radians out of phase, it's exactly flipped, right? Because it shifted. If it's 2 pi, they're lined up again. Right? So it's obviously kind of periodic with period, the phase that gives you periodic responses with period 2 pi. So the idea then is that for a linear system, the sinusoidal frequency response can be captured in terms of the gain and the phase, these two numbers. Now, we defined step response, and we sort of looked at step response for general systems. Frequency response is typically only defined for linear systems. In particular, you really can't talk about frequency response for nonlinear systems because the system nonlinearities can generate harmonics. So if you have a nonlinear system and you put in a sinusoid at some frequency, you might get out sinusoids at different frequencies. And so it doesn't make sense anymore to say what's the magnitude and phase because I put in, say, sine of omega t and I got out something that was sine of omega t plus some 2 omega t and 3 omega t and other omega, right, other harmonics of that. And so we usually don't talk about the frequency response of a nonlinear system. It's also the case that if you have a nonlinear system and you change the amplitude, even if you were getting a sinusoidal output, the gain might change as a function of the amplitude. For linear systems, that ratio will always be constant. If I double the input, I'll double the output, so right, the two factors will divide out. For nonlinear systems, not true. So we'll only talk about frequency response for linear systems, and so if somebody talks about the frequency response of a nonlinear system, you say, wait a minute, be careful, does that make any sense? All right, so these frequency responses are going to be one of the main tools that we use for looking at linear systems, so we ought to talk about how to compute them. So how do you compute out a frequency response? Well, one technique, of course, is to do what I just did, which is essentially to go into MATLAB or Simulink. You all now know how to simulate the response to a sinusoid, right? Just put in U equals sine T, right? Run it through Simulink. So plot the input versus the output, calculate out the gain, calculate out the phase, and then I can look at how the gain and phase depend on the frequency that I'm forcing it at. So I can do that calculation. It's very long, tedious, but you can go do it. Of course, it's a linear system, it's a controls class, MATLAB, so you know that there is a command that does all of this for you. Right? And so here's what a frequency response looks like using what's called the Bode command. So Henrik Bode, his name is pronounced Bode, but everybody calls them Bode plots. So the guy's probably rolling over in his grave because everybody mispronounces his last name, but I will too. So a Bode plot is a specific type of frequency response plot. What we plot is the frequency of the input in radians per second on a log scale on the horizontal axis. And then as a function of that frequency, we plot the magnitude, that's the gain, and the phase, that's the change in the shifting of the frequency. So we plot exactly the gain, AY over AU, and the phase. We plot the gain on a log scale. We plot the phase on a linear scale. And if you do this in MATLAB, because MATLAB was, I guess, written by electrical engineers or something, they use these funky units called dBs. If you look in the book, you'll see that we always do it correctly, which is to just plot what the gain is, right? It's either 10 to the 1, 10 to the 2, right? It's just a number. But in electrical engineering, if you have gain, then you don't plot the log of the gain. You plot log base 10 of the gain times 20, and this is in units of dBs. So in particular, 20 dB corresponds to a gain of 10, 40 dB corresponds to a gain of 100. Okay. My preference would be, by the way, that you not use dBs because they don't make any sense outside of electrical engineering particularly. right? You really care about the just what's the ratios, a factor of 100, factor of 1,000, whatever it is. All right, but nonetheless, that's what the Bode plot does, so that's what you get if you use MATLAB. It obviously assumes dynamics in a certain form, and you basically give it the A, B, C, D matrices, and it will generate this plot for you. So in fact, if you just give it A, B, C, D, out pops this plot. So very easy to plot the frequency response of a linear system. All right, so this is the idea then of the frequency response. So suppose, for example, that you had a linear system, and I'll use an electrical engineering example today. So this is a circuit that's called a bridged T circuit. Don't worry if you don't know what a bridged T circuit is. But suppose that we want to look at how the output here depends on the input coming from this oscillating input. So we have some input voltage that we're going to assume to be a sinusoid at different frequencies or a combination of sinusoids at frequencies. We have this circuit in the middle, and we want to know what does the output look like. And so if we want to do that, we need to write a linear system to do that. So in electrical engineering, you use Kirchhoff's circuit laws. So those circuit laws say that, in particular, the sum of the currents at nodes, and there are nodes here, here, and here, so there are the nodes. So the sum of the currents at nodes is always zero, so you can't accumulate charge, and so you can use that to write down a bunch of equations. So this is the sum of the current at node, I think this one's the sum of the current at node 2, and this one's the sum of the current at node 3, and this is based on the dynamics of capacitors and resistors. And so if these equations don't make sense, go back and look at your Phys 2 text, or take a course in electrical engineering, but this is the language that would be used there. We can then rewrite these dynamics in terms of some states. We have to pick the states. Here I'll pick the states to be V2 and V3 minus V1. And if I choose those states, then I can write down the dynamics in this form. So a little exercise is to go through and verify that these dynamics in state-space form with this choice of states looks like this. All right. Now, once I've gotten it into this form, so it takes a little work to get there, there's the A matrix. There's the B matrix, that's my input. There's the C matrix, there's the D matrix is equal to 1. So I can pick off A, B, C, D. If I now want to know what's the frequency response, Bode of A, B, C, D. Right? If I want to know how does that vary as a function of changing the resistances and the capacitances, change the resistances and capacitances, put in another Bode command. Right? So this is something that you'll do a lot for the various systems that we look at, is to calculate out Bode plots. All right, so the Bode plot and the frequency response allow us to understand the performance of a linear system. So I'm sort of just putting up that these things all come out in this form. Let's dive in a little bit and look more at what's the form of the solution for a general input, not just sinusoids, and then we can pick out sinusoids as a special case. So let's kind of come back to just the general linear system. We already saw that the... if I don't have any input, that the response is given by C e to the ATX0, where e to the AT is the matrix exponential. And if you remember back to linear differential equations, this is a homogeneous response of a linear system, right? The response with no input. And what I want is the particular solution, the homogeneous solution. I want the particular solution of this particular system, and we want to know how do we get that. So because it's a linear system, we can do some things with it that allow us to compute the input in a certain way. And I'm going to kind of sketch that today. You can read about it more in the book, but I'm going to go through it in detail on Wednesday. And the basic idea is to use the notion of what's called an impulse response. So here's the idea. Suppose that I apply a very short input, right? I very quickly just pulse the system. And when I pulse the system with this impulse, I get some output from the system. Right? And so you can think of this as being a very short, sharp pulse of some amplitude, and it generates some output, which I record. We'll call that the impulse response, and we'll show that the impulse response can be written as C e to the AT times B. That's what's called the impulse response of a system. That generates this curve. There is a MATLAB function called impulse that generates that for you. Okay. If you've taken 95, you've probably heard of Green's functions. This is the equivalent of a Green's function, so it's exactly the same thing. All right, now suppose we have a general input of this form, and we want to compute out what the output looks like. Now we can use linearity of the system. In particular, we can break up this system into a series of impulses, and we can calculate the output corresponding to each of these impulses. And when you do that, you get a bunch of different outputs. And in fact, For an impulse, we know exactly what those outputs look like. They're just scaled and shifted versions of a unit impulse, right? So if I put an impulse in that's 50% bigger, I get an impulse out that's 50% bigger. If I put one in that's, you know, 10% lower, I get an output that's 10% lower. Right? And I can just shift those back and forth. And so now, the response of the system is basically the sum of these impulses, right? So imagine I had kind of an infinite number of these things all stacked up right next to one another. Then I could make this curve from the sum of all of those. The impulse is zero every place except at that point. So I would break it up into the sum of a bunch of those. Through superposition, I could then sum up the outputs. And so sort of graphically what happens is that I take the sum of those inputs and I get the sum of those outputs. So this corresponds to calculating the output based on this impulse response. And we're going to derive this formula on Wednesday, but if you do that carefully, and it's also derived in the book, what you get is that the output of a linear system has the following specific form. It is the initial condition response plus this integral. And the integral is the integral from tau equals 0 to capital T, C e to the AT minus tau, B U of tau, D tau, plus D U of T. And what's happening is this sum here, right, you see this is the impulse response, shifted by tau. And so all I'm doing is I'm just shifting those things and adding them together, but I'm doing it sort of at infinitely fine slices, and so my sum becomes an integral. Right? And again, we'll derive this carefully on Wednesday, but this formula is the magic formula for linear systems. If you know this formula, you can derive everything that you ever cared about for linear systems. So, we can already see a lot of things about the system just from this. For example, if my input u is zero, we immediately see that my output is linear in the initial condition. Why? Because e to the at is a matrix, so if I put in two different initial conditions and I put the sum of those two, I just get the sum of the outputs. Similarly, integrals are linear in this argument, right? So if I take u1 and I take u2 and then I try u1 plus u2, I'll just replace u here with u1 plus u2, and that'll be the integral of u1 plus the integral of u2, which is the initial condition, I mean the forced responses, right? The input-output responses corresponding to that input. You can do that with the D term as well. We also see that if I double the input, I get double the output, etc. But notice that it is jointly linear in x0 and u. So that was why we had to set x0 equal to 0 when we talked about linearity and superposition in the input output. If I take a non-zero x0 and I take u1 plus u2, then I have to add up twice of the initial conditions, right? So if we set this to 0, we get linearity in the integral. If we set this to 0, we get linearity in the initial condition. So it's jointly linear in initial condition and input. Right? All right, so this formula is one, again, that we'll derive very carefully. As you might guess, there's a MATLAB command for this as well. And in fact, all of the things that you could possibly want to compute for this have MATLAB commands that go along with them. So if I want just the initial condition response, I use initial. If I want just the impulse response, that's this piece here, I use impulse. If I want the response to an arbitrary signal, then you use LSIM for linear simulation. In all cases, you basically just pass it A, B, C, and D, which in MATLAB you can kind of combine into a single element by saying a system is a state space system defined by A, B, C, D. Take the initial of the system with respect to an initial condition, initial condition response with respect to initial condition, impulse response, general output response, frequency response with the Bode command. So turns out there are lots of MATLAB functions for dealing with linear systems. So you can generate different types of signals and run them through this. You can look at different types of time domain analysis, different types of frequency domain analysis. And there's a tool that you might want to play with called LTI View that lets you look at various properties. And we'll talk more about LTI View in a couple of weeks. All right, so we've got this idea of a convolution integral for linear systems. There's a ton of tools that are available for analyzing linear systems. If every system were linear, it'd be great. We'd be done, right? That's all we'd have to do. But we do have to worry at least a little bit about nonlinear systems. And there are a couple of things we can do with nonlinear systems. The most common, by far, is to look at something called linearization. So suppose I have a nonlinear system like the one we've looked at, and I'm really interested in the behavior around this equilibrium point. Then what I can do is I can say, well, look, if I focus in around this equilibrium point and I only care about what happens in a local neighborhood, then I can approximate this nonlinear system by a linear system. because near an equilibrium point, maybe it will turn out that a linear system is a good approximation. So we have to show some things to sort of prove that, but the idea is the following, which is if I linearize the system around x0, essentially what I do is I compute a Taylor series expansion of f and h around that point. And if I compute a Taylor series expansion of f, it's going to be f evaluated at xe, that's 0, plus the derivative of f evaluated at that equilibrium point, plus the second derivative of f, third derivative, etc. And if I only care about the linear terms around that equilibrium point, I'm just going to keep that first derivative. And so in this form, a will be equal to the derivative of f with respect to x evaluated at the equilibrium point, b the derivative of f with respect to u evaluated at that equilibrium point, similar for c and d using h. So given an equilibrium point, I can define A, B, C, and D in this particular way. And then I can ask the question, is this a good approximation to the dynamics around this point? And it's going to turn out that you can prove if I'm sufficiently close, it will be a good approximation. Right? And sufficiently close, how close you need to get depends on the particular system. For this system, which you'll remember is the inverted pendulum with damping, here I'm looking over a range of about 0 to maybe pi over 4, something like that. Pi is, well, maybe a little bit more. 2/3 pi over 3 or something like that. So there's the dynamics in that box. If I then go and calculate out these values and compute the phase portrait for the linear system, I get a different plot, that plot. These really are two different plots. You can go look on the web at the MATLAB code that I used to generate the plots. You'll see that this one is the nonlinear system and this one's the linear system. But they are virtually identical in that neighborhood. So that means if I care about analyzing what's going on here, the stable hanging down equilibrium point, then I can use the linearization around that point. And so that allows me to use my tools that I have available by focusing in on that point. So it turns out that in a lot of examples, this is equivalent to things that you've already probably done in physics and other places using small angle approximations and other things. One thing to keep in mind is that it only works near an equilibrium point because away from an equilibrium point, the first term in the Taylor series expansion is not zero, right? First term in a Taylor series expansion, right, is f of xe ue plus the derivative times the deltas around that, and this needs to be zero in order to get that linear term to pop out. All right, here's another example of that type of a calculation, just sort of worked out so you see what one looks like. Suppose that I care about this particular system. So you've seen the security guards riding one of these around. Maybe you have one yourself. This is essentially a cart with an inverted pendulum above it. Right? The dynamics of the Segway are the same as the dynamics of a cart with inverted pendulum. What happens is the wheels push on the cart, right? So that's a force that you apply here. I look at the position of the center of the cart, which is the center of the wheels, and I can look at the angle that the body makes with respect to that, right? And that's a little pendulum sitting on top. And of course, it's actively balancing you on top of this, right? That's what the Segway does. So if I want to write down the dynamics of that system, this is what the dynamics look like for that system. This B should be a C, and these dynamics are sitting in the book. They are part of homework set number, well, this homework set that I'm just handing out today, I think problem number 3? Is that the one? 4? Okay, problem set number 4. Be careful. These equations are different than the ones in the book. It was a change in where theta is. Use the equations in the book, and be careful. The equations in the book are wrong. So use the equations on the errata sheet in the book. So if you go look now on the CDS homepage, on the CDS 110 homepage, you'll see an errata up in the right-hand corner where it used to say AM Wiki. It now says errata. Click on that, and you'll see some of the errors in the book. One of them is in this set of equations. Right, so get the right equations for your homework. Okay, but nonetheless, you can see this is a nonlinear equation. It has state x theta, x dot theta dot. The inputs are the force F that I apply down here. The outputs are the position of this particular cart. And I can linearize this according to the previous formula around theta equals 0, that is the upright position. And a good calculation to do, which essentially you're going to do on your homework, is to show that if you do that, you get x dot equals ax plus bu plus and y equals cx. And this is an approximation of the dynamics around this vertical position. And we can use this approximation to, for example, design the control system for a Segway that keeps you balanced. Right? And it will hold over a large enough range, right, that unless you're President Bush, right, it will stabilize you. Right? So people may remember that Bush didn't do so well on a Segway. Right? David Baltimore didn't do so well on a Segway one time. Right? So if you put it outside of its range, bad stuff can happen. Right? It can only do so much. Okay, so this is an example where we're taking a nonlinear system, replacing it by a linear system, an approximation, and we want to use this linear system, this model, to ask the question, how should I design my control input to balance this? What we're going to do next week in class is, in fact, go and design control systems for this, use as a function of the state that stabilizes the system. All right, so we've introduced today this notion of a linear system. So a linear system is a system that has the form x dot equals ax plus bu, y equals cx. If the initial condition is zero, then we get the principle of superposition, namely that if I take an input and I get an output, and a second input and I get an output, if I look at the sum or weighted sums of those two inputs, I get the weighted sum of those two outputs. Corresponding outputs. The general formula is the convolution integral, which we'll derive and look at in more detail on Wednesday. And from this, we can derive essentially everything that we need to know about this system. The properties that we care about are that a linear system is linear with respect to the initial condition. The stability of a linear system is characterized by the eigenvalues. There are lots of applications and tools, and we can use linear systems even for non-linear models, even for non-linear systems, by doing these local approximations. Okay, so on Wednesday we'll go into more technical detail on these, and on Friday we'll look at some of the performance measures and second order systems. All right, that's it.